First of all, thank you for Professor M. Gochai to organize this with the Sebastian and then Kai and then Ken is not here. And I'm very pleased to be here to be part of this launch of new project led by Professor Ochai. So today I will talk about double responsibility of care. And then this is the not only my work, I have been working with some Japanese and other East Asian scholars. And I will present some initial findings from our fieldwork research and then present some implications from our current findings. So what is double responsibility of care? The definition is the situations in which women, sometimes men, but I haven't seen any of men doing it, have to simultaneously provide elderly care and then child care. So this is an issue that I think the Professor Thierry talked about. What happens when the women start to have a baby later at their life stage? So our project aim is to examine the experience of women facing the double responsibility of care, and then identify future risks to women, family, communities, and social policy in Japan and the other East Asian societies, and to contribute to the development of feminist social policies. And today I would like to show you and then talk about the reasons why research on double responsibility of care is timely and important, and what we found out so far from our fieldwork. So this is, I will focus on case of Japan, but this is a part of the wider project founded by Japanese government, JSPS, about double responsibility of care in East Asia. So we have been working together, scholar from Hong Kong, South Korea, and Taiwan. So just a brief background and emergence of double responsibility of care. Later marriage means later age at first birth. At the same time, low birth rate and aging society. Now it's the last year, 25.1% in Japan. So number of double care households has been increasing rapidly. And it's happening, this increase happening under the sibling and the relative network is getting smaller. But also after 2000, the expansion of elderly and then child care, public elderly and then child care in the last two decades in Japan. So that the context is quite different. If you look at intergenerational relations, there are two generations possibly doing double responsibility of care. The first one is the very green one on the middle, on the green background. So that's the first baby boomers born in between 1947 to 1949. Who is taking care of maybe elderly parents, but at the same time doing grandparenting. And another double responsibility of carers is the second baby boomers, born in 1971 and 74 in Japan, who is doing elderly care parents, parents care, and then child care at the same time. Our project is focusing on this second double responsibility carer, who are in late 30s, early 40s, so they have small children at the same time frail elderly. Just an overview, basic overview of elderly care and then child care. In Japan, elderly care and then child care have seen the rapid expansion in the last two decades. For elderly care, the introduction of Long-Term Act 2000, relatively generous coverage. Nearly 18% of over 65 are eligible to receive LTCI service, long-term care services, providing comprehensive institutional and home-based services, and a stronger state financial commitment than any other East Asian societies. In terms of child care, deregulation of child care providers and the mechanism of quasi-market have been promoted since 1990s, which resulted in the expansion of the profit, the private organizations. The problem of care deficit, which means all-day nursery or short-term nursery, has been a serious issue, social issue, especially in urban area. But in the local areas, kindergartens do not meet children's quota. So there is a difference in the urban and then cities in Japan. This shows shows the expansion of public long-term care in Japan. So the long-term care coverage is higher than OECD average on the middle, on the orange. So Japan is just the next to the OECD average. And under the OECD average, on your right side, Finland, Germany, France, Hungary, Spain, and United States, and so on. So Japan rapidly expanded the proportion of aged 65 year and over receiving public long-term care. And also, this is quite interesting data from OECD. People aged 65 and over living in institutions or receiving formal care at home as a share of people aged 65 and over, comparing 2000 and 2006. So if you can remember, the introduction of Long-Term Care Insurance Act happened in 2000. And you can see the triangle bit is at 2000, and then bar bit is 2006. Only Japan increased the percentage of all the people receiving public long-term care. And also the higher percentage staying at home and then receiving some kind of public home care. And then now, if you look at it, it's now the over the United Kingdom, Belgium, Germany, Luxembourg, and France as well. So now the Japanese public long-term care service is the generous, I could say, than some European societies. Why then I would like to move back to why I started to have interest in double responsibility of care. Because the concept of double responsibility of care, or sandwich generation in the European literature term, is missing in the research in the following areas, even though we thought this is a significant emerging risk for women and the family and the social policy. For example, not so much discussion in social care literature, feminist social policy, new social risks, or the sandwich generation literature is there, but tend to look at, because it's European-based literature, tend to look at the first sandwich generation, which I call it as the grandparenting and elderly care. But in East Asia, because of people getting to give a birth at much later stage of their life, not the sandwich generation, but the women in 30s and then 40s doing double responsibility care, is quite important population to look at. And also there is little available data existing regarding this group of women doing both care. So we did a mixed method approach. This is in Japan, quantitative approach with 3 stages. Now we start in 4th stage this June. So they started from child support centers, and the second stage was bigger one with mobile survey. So people receiving this email magazine of the child care services. We did the survey via this email magazine. And also we did with the after school daycare centers and another type of child care support centers. And in urban areas and in rural areas. And also we did 33 semi-structured interviews with 13 focus group. In a comparative way, we did a smaller scale in Korea, in Taiwan, and Hong Kong, but total more than 3,000 cases for questionnaire survey. And all this, the sampling is someone who are having under 6 years old children. And in case of Korea and then Hong Kong, Taiwan and then Hong Kong, we just did questionnaire survey with 6-year-old children, and already we know taking care of parents as well. But Japan and Korea are just sampling the women with children under 6 years old, but we didn't know whether they are taking care of elderly parents too. So in total, we have 90 cases for the qualitative interview too. The first, this is in Japan. I would like to present some results from three-stage questionnaire quantitative survey. As you can see, the second stage, because the first stage was the children's support center, which means that their children are age until 3, so very young children. But the mobile survey one is the mothers with children 5 and 6. And then you can see it, around 10% of the mothers saying they are facing double responsibility of care, including orange ones in the past, and then the gray one will experience almost about to do it. And 40% says, yes, I'm in doing the double responsibility care, which was much higher percentage than we expected. And looking at the employment status, about 40% of respondents currently experiencing, and 60% who did in past double responsibility of care in the employment. And this is showing the which kind of burdens or the difficulties they have. And I'm not going to go into the detail, but it shows the sort of multi-layered burdens they have, including finance and then physical and then psychological burden. What's very interesting to comparatively to look at, it showed that Japan and Korea tend to have, the women tend to feel much more burden than Taiwan and then Hong Kong, which at this stage I can only explain from the Taiwan and Hong Kong, they tend to have domestic workers, migrant workers at home. But that's not popular in Korea and in Japan. That means women actually facing the responsibility of care at home without sort of 24 hours help. So who support these women who doing the responsibility of care is the, you can see it, the green color one. Yeah, you can still see as a green, is care managers, home helpers, and nursery school staff. So the green ones are the care professionals, which you wouldn't expect it 20 years ago in Japan. So you can see it, care professionals are getting so important to support these women. However, at the same time, you would notice that no one available to help consists 12 and then 15%. So, which is not a small percentage of the people doing double responsibility of care with isolation. I just want to show you some examples of what means double responsibility of care. So example of case one, YD is cohabitating with mother, own mother, and she quitted her job when she had first son. And now full-time housewife, and she's only child, and she has 5 and 3 years old son. The double care situation is mother is diabetes, almost blind, and wheelchair user. Husband is not around home much due to his occupation as firefighters. A week schedule is filled with double care activities. And she has high burden and stress, and really exhausted every day. Financial burden is high as well. And the previous job as a kindergarten teacher, so YD is dedicated to childcare, but she cannot do what she wants to do for children due to mother's care. And YD struggles to go out with mother and then 2 small children because she cannot push wheelchair and then buggy. So she's sort of stuck in the household. Another case, YB, living in the same neighborhood, 10 minutes walk, and she also quitted job when she had a first son, and then she has 1 older sister, 2 children of 6 and then 2 years old. And her situation, supporting father's everyday life, who had a stroke, and then have a physical disability in his half body, and mild dementia. She visits him every day and helps him to go to daycare center 2 times a week. Mother is a main carer, but she's still working. So her mother is very, and also her mother is very upset and about his father's health situation. So she's also mediating mother and father's relationship, but she's the almost main carer for her father too. And also she has a high burden and stress, wishing if she did not have the second son, her life would be better and could have provided more care to her father because she really wants to support her father. And tried to use short-term temporary nursery service, but was really difficult because she's not working. And feel sorry for the first son as her involvement with father's care gave him some burden and stress as well. and cannot talk about caring father with her friends because her friends are in 30s, so they don't experience it, so they can share the experience, so feeling isolated and wanted to disappear when her first son was reluctant to go to school and required her internship support, but she couldn't give him. She was too busy to take care of father, but had to keep taking care of father as well. Another example, so the first example, living in urban area. So urban area tend to have housewives too. And this is another example from rural area. Living apart, so 2 hours drive to father's house, and 3 part-time employments she has. And she has an elder brother, and she has 3 children of 9, 6, and then 3 years old. And her situation is father had a stroke and then physical disability and then lost speech. And he was recommended to be in a nursing home, but care respects father's preference to live at home. So he lives at home. When he came back from home, from hospital, Kay visited him twice a week, but now refrained herself from visiting him as Kay managed to organize daily care services and also cannot bear its financial cost to visit him in terms of petrol and so on, and also lost the opportunity to do that her part-time. So Kay wants to visit him more, but cannot afford. She juggles 3 part-time jobs to support family, worried about what happens when her father needs more care. In a rural area, because nursing, the childcare is more available. So the childcare doesn't become an issue more, the finance becomes an issue. So we found the key factors for understanding, so which kind of conditions and situations people have with double responsibility of care, was key factors could be the age and the health of parents and parents-in-law. Interestingly, in Japan, if your parents' demand of care is very high, they tend to be institution. So the higher level of need of care of parents doesn't give burden or more difficulty for women. Relationship with the parents and parents-in-law, also Hong Kong and then Japan, if you have a good relationship with parents, they tend to feel more burden because they want to take care of both parents and children. And relationship hazard, household finance, and which types of service they use, and living conditions and employment. So characteristics of double responsibility of care. So it is the need to simultaneously respond to different types of needs from children and frail elderly, and forced to make priority between childcare and elderly care. And it's under the influence of social norms on care, who should take care of children, who should take care of elderly parents, which kind of resource they have in terms of husband, relatives, friends, local community, and finance. The policy configuration matters quite a lot, availability and accessibility of care services and policy discourse. Even they want to take care of parents, if there is not enough nursing and child care, they might not be able to provide, so they get more stress. Also, the introduction of the long-term care has created care activities which generate new types of caring responsibilities, which is care management. So that means more women are involved in double responsibility care who live away from the elderly parents but manage all the care services from the distance. So the conclusion, double care responsibility of care creates multiple issues from providing both care. This is particularly true in East Asia. The literature on the sandwich generation in Europe says that people tend to have higher priority on child care, and elderly care tend to be considered as the parents' responsibility, not the children as a sandwich generation's responsibility. But in the East Asia, the women tend to have tensions between who should be provided, who should be prioritized in terms of child care or elderly care. And we need to consider child care and elderly care as a unit in social policy research and process, and social services to deal with child care and elderly care together. And then this is, I'm aware that proposing more intervention into private life, but intergenerational relations and then family support rather than child care and elderly care. And also, theoretically, to examine the configuration of multiple women's roles as mother, wife, employee, and then daughter in law and daughters in law, and re-examine feminist social policy in order to incorporate such multiple roles of women. Thank you very much.
Bonjour, donc je m'appelle Isabelle Konouma et je vais intervenir en français. Enfin, j'espère que vous réussirez à suivre néanmoins puisque j'ai traduit l'ensemble de mon intervention en anglais. Donc, je suis spécialiste du droit de la famille et des politiques de la reproduction au Japon depuis le 19e siècle jusqu'à aujourd'hui. Et donc, j'avais prévu en fait d'intervenir sur vraiment une question plus large et théorique, mais afin de rester dans le temps qui m'est imparti, j'ai décidé de me vraiment focaliser sur la question des politiques de la reproduction et l'accueil de l'enfant à travers la loi relative à la protection du corps maternel de 1996, qui est donc une loi qui introduit, enfin, c'est une loi qui réforme une ancienne loi de 48 qui a introduit donc des mesures très importantes en matière de l'avortement, puisque elle a permis de dépénaliser, disons, énormément l'avortement. Donc, mon hypothèse, disons, de base. Enfin, c'est vraiment une question très simple que je me suis posée en regardant les mesures juridiques qui portent notamment sur l'égalisation du genre. Comme je m'intéresse principalement à la question des politiques de la reproduction, je trouvais qu'effectivement, il y avait très peu finalement de mesures qui portaient directement sur la reproduction, puisque comme par exemple, donc là, vous avez juste une... Je vous donne un exemple qui est donc la loi du 4 août 2014, la loi française sur l'égalité réelle entre les femmes et les hommes. Donc l'article 1 énonce un certain nombre d'objectifs à atteindre. Et donc effectivement, dans ces objectifs-là, on voit très clairement la lutte contre les violences, contre le sexisme, pour l'égal accès dans le domaine politique, professionnel et social, etc., etc. Et finalement, quand on regarde notamment également les sites internet, par exemple, du gouvernement français, du service public ou alors du ministère des droits des femmes, on voit très peu de mesures qui portent directement sur la question de la reproduction. Et pourtant, la loi, dans son quatrième point, dit clairement pour assurer aux femmes la maîtrise de leur sexualité, notamment par l'accès à la contraception et à l'interruption volontaire de la grossesse. Ce qui ne veut pas dire, bien sûr, qu'il n'y aurait pas de mesures qui porteraient directement sur cette question-là, mais en tous les cas, il y a très peu de visibilité, si vous voulez, d'un niveau politique qui tendrait de lier peut-être l'aspect reproduction à la question du genre. Donc, dans un premier temps, j'aimerais parler du régime de l'avortement dans le Japon d'après-guerre, très rapidement, pour vous donner quelques éléments de réflexion et effectivement essayer d'analyser cette question en relation avec la question du quai. Donc, les politiques au Japon, donc attribuant aux femmes le travail domestique, ont en quelque sorte été légitimés, bien évidemment, par l'aspect biologique de la reproduction, par l'aspect, disons, naturel de la reproduction. Et donc, ces aspects biologiques ou naturels de la reproduction ont elles-mêmes fait l'objet d'un processus de fabrication politique. Pourtant, donc, le refus de la maternité, qui touche un aspect, bien évidemment, biologique du corps féminin, peut résulter du refus d'endosser le rôle de mère tel configuré socialement et politiquement. Donc, bien évidemment, il y a un lien entre le refus de maternité et puis les valeurs qui nous entourent, en quelque sorte, des valeurs morales, sociales, familiales, qui font qu'à un certain moment, les femmes acceptent de donner vie ou alors refusent tout simplement de donner vie. Et donc, dans la période dans la période de l'après-guerre au Japon, nous connaissons donc une loi extrêmement importante qui est donc la loi de 48 dont je vous ai parlé tout à l'heure, qui a dépénalisé considérablement l'avortement. Et donc j'aimerais vraiment partir de cette loi qui me paraît très intéressante et importante pour comprendre pourquoi finalement le Japon a dépénalisé l'avortement bien avant la France, bien avant les différents pays occidentaux. La loi de 48 définissait quatre possibilités d'avortement. Donc, il y avait la possibilité d'avorter en cas de problème de santé chez la mère, donc ce sont des avortements thérapeutiques, en cas de problème financier. Donc, justement, c'est un point très intéressant puisque ça montre que, en réalité, on peut faire recours à un avortement quand le cadre n'est pas là, quand le cadre financier n'est pas là pour accueillir l'enfant, en cas de grossesse suite à une relation sexuelle non consentie, donc en cas de viol par exemple, et quatrième condition, c'est une condition eugénique, lorsque par exemple les parents sont porteurs donc de tout simplement de maladies génétiquement transmissibles. Et donc, dans ces quatre cas, hypothèses, la femme peut demander l'avortement. Et donc, cette loi a été modifiée en 1996, et la quatrième condition qui portait sur l'eugénisme, en quelque sorte, hein, donc sur la malformation ou sur les problèmes génétiques, a été supprimée, puisque, justement, l'eugénisme a été complètement éradiqué de la politique de la reproduction au Japon à cette date-là. Il faut tout de même noter que donc, la loi de 96, donc ça c'est les trois conditions qui restent depuis 96 pour, dans le cadre de la dépénalisation de l'avortement, il faut notamment souligner que la loi de 48, donc, qui a défini un régime qui a souvent été qualifié de précurseur dans ce domaine, a été portée donc, par des féministes, comme par exemple Kato Shizue, qui est vraiment une figure représentative du féminisme japonais, et qui faisait partie justement de la diète, enfin de tous les débats politiques qui ont lieu à cette période-là. Donc le mouvement féministe n'était pas absent. Néanmoins, il y a eu trois autres personnes, trois autres députés, médecins, qui ont été, qui ont joué un rôle déterminant, si vous voulez, dans ce processus, puisque nous avons par exemple Ota Tenle, qui est un gynécologue-obstétricien, également membre de la Chambre des représentants, Fukuda Masako et Taniguchi Asablo, donc tous trois médecins, gynécologues-obstétriciens et députés. Donc nous savons que ces quatre personnages ont joué un rôle déterminant dans l'élaboration de ce régime d'après-guerre. Alors, que dit ce régime, notamment en ce qui concerne les acteurs dans l'avortement ? Est-ce que la femme est seule, en quelque sorte, responsable de ce choix ? Et bien évidemment, non. Et justement, c'est là où on pourrait peut-être réutiliser ce fameux diamant pour voir qui a le plus de pouvoir dans le domaine de l'avortement. Donc nous pouvons, par exemple, bien sûr, mettre la femme en premier plan, puisque c'est la femme qui concrètement consulte pour se faire avorter. Mais nous pouvons également, bien sûr, citer l'État, qui prévoit un cadre dans lequel l'avortement est possible. Nous pouvons également citer donc les médecins, le corps professionnel, le corps médical, qui a un énorme pouvoir dans ce domaine-là. Et puis enfin, il y a aussi le mari, hein, que ce soit un mari marié ou un concubin, qui doit donner son accord en cas d'avortement. Donc effectivement, il y a quatre acteurs majeurs dans le domaine de l'avortement. Et c'est justement cette question que j'aimerais poursuivre, j'aimerais analyser par rapport à la question du care dans un deuxième temps. Alors, la question qui en quelque sorte suit cette interrogation est la suivante. Donc, puisque en quelque sorte il est possible de se faire avorter, quelles sont les causes qui sont avancées par la femme au moment de l'avortement ? Et donc, c'est justement la question du cadre, l'accueil de l'enfant qui se pose à ce niveau-là, puisque, comme vous pouvez le voir ici, donc ça, ce sont les sources. Hein. C'est une étude qui a été faite par Hayashi Jodi, qui a donc fait des recensements en 94 et 95 dans 6 universités à Tokyo. Et donc, ces données sont assez intéressantes puisque on peut apercevoir donc les raisons pour lesquelles les femmes optent pour l'avortement, notamment. Donc, vous pouvez voir dans 5 colonnes différentes les causes avancées par les femmes concernées. Et donc, on peut voir que le premier avortement est très souvent causé par le statut donc marital, ou le célibat, plus précisément, de la femme. Donc, presque 50% des premiers avortements résultent justement de cette situation. La deuxième cause avancée dans ce cadre-là, c'est la cause suivante. Donc, c'est une grossesse non planifiée. Donc, il y a une question, encore une fois, de planification de la grossesse qui se pose. Et dans le deuxième avortement, là, par contre, les causes se déplacent un peu. Par exemple, le célibat est toujours important, disons essentiel même. Pourtant, donc, on voit qu'il y a la malformation fœtale qui commence à, enfin, qui trouve une certaine importance dans le deuxième avortement. Et après, donc, le troisième, quatrième, cinquième, je n'entre pas vraiment dans les détails, mais on peut voir globalement que c'est une question de planification. Donc, tout simplement, la grossesse n'avait pas été planifiée. Hein. Et donc, c'est vraiment les causes majeures qui sont avancées pour le troisième avortement, enfant non désiré, quatrième avortement, grossesse non planifiée, cinquième avortement, grossesse non planifiée également. Et dans ces statistiques, ce qui m'a paru intéressant, c'est qu'effectivement, là, il y a par exemple, à la demande du partenaire, hein, donc la femme avait la possibilité de dire que l'avortement a eu lieu à la demande donc du conjoint ou du mari. Or, finalement, le chiffre qui porte sur cette... sont données dans ce cadre-là, reste assez bas. Donc on voit que la part, disons, du conjoint reste assez mineure, hein, dans ce processus de décision. Donc pour résumer en quelque sorte ces chiffres, il me paraît néanmoins intéressant de rappeler que finalement l'avortement est très souvent motivé soit par la question du cadre marital, soit par la question de la planification de la grossesse. Et donc, bien sûr, là, c'est une hypothèse à certainement développer, mais donc la femme qui prend une décision d'avorter, finalement, la prend par rapport à sa possibilité d'accueillir l'enfant. Donc la question du care se pose à ce niveau-là. Est-ce qu'elle peut accueillir cet enfant? Est-ce qu'elle peut s'occuper, se charger concrètement de l'entretien de cet enfant? Et c'est précisément ce point-là qui a une influence, je pense, directe sur la décision que prend la femme au moment de la grossesse. Donc certainement, enfin, la question du diamant du care, je ne sais pas si on peut encore une fois le transposer dans la question de la reproduction et de l'avortement, mais très clairement, au Japon, on voit quand même que la femme a une grande part décisionnelle. L'État et les médecins s'effacent dans ce schéma-là, puisque certes, le code pénal interdit l'avortement, mais les exceptions sont tellement nombreuses, sont tellement pratiquées que de fait, il y a une dépénalisation totale de l'avortement. Donc l'État, dans l'état actuel des choses, en tous les cas, s'est effacé dans ce domaine. Le corps médical s'est effacé en quelque sorte également, puisque finalement, le médecin ne contrôle pas la véracité des causes rapportées. Par exemple, une femme qui dit qu'elle veut se faire avorter pour des raisons financières, les médecins ne vont pas contrôler, ne vont pas vérifier si effectivement la femme serait dans une situation financièrement difficile. Et donc, il reste la femme et le conjoint. Et d'après ce tableau qui nous le rappelle très, très clairement, la demande du partenaire ne pèse pas énormément dans cette décision. Alors, en ce qui concerne donc, je vais mettre ça tout à l'heure. Donc, je vais essayer de conclure rapidement quand même parce que il nous reste très peu de temps. Finalement, donc, le choix est fait par la femme, notamment qui consulte sa situation familiale, sa situation, conjugale, maritale. Dans la conclusion, j'aimerais reparler de la question de l'autonomie de la femme, finalement, dans ce processus. Est-ce que la loi de 48 avait élargi donc la possibilité d'avorter pour donner davantage d'autonomie aux femmes? Et je pense que c'est une question qui est quand même assez intéressante et importante, puisque, comme nous avons vu tout à l'heure, les acteurs, le législateur hein, de 48 est en grande partie issu donc du corps médical. Et il faut également rappeler que dans les années 1960, 70 et 80, il y a eu énormément de débats au Japon entre, par exemple, les féministes et les personnes pour le droit des personnes handicapées sur la question de l'avortement. Et on a vécu donc une période où le droit à l'avortement n'a pas pu être exprimé clairement. Même les féministes ont en quelque sorte préféré éviter l'utilisation du mot droit à l'avortement pour ne pas s'opposer très clairement donc au droit, par exemple, à la vie du fœtus. Et donc, cette autonomie, je pense néanmoins apparente, hein, reflète en quelque sorte la féminisation de la reproduction et du care, un lien qui ne devrait pas être sous-estimé. La suppression juridique de l'eugénisme en 1996 s'inscrit dans un contexte de dénatalité et de détermination d'un cadre politique précis, celui de démocratisation du diagnostic prénatal et de l'assistance médicale à la procréation. Et bien évidemment, les deux doivent être rapprochés, puisqu'elles n'ont pas été motivées, même si elles n'ont pas été motivées par les mêmes préoccupations politiques, elles s'inscrivent dans le même cadre politique. Alors, l'un des enjeux actuels au Japon est donc de permettre aux couples qui présenteraient un cadre d'accueil correct, hein, d'avoir des enfants, ce qu'on a vu tout à l'heure avec justement la question de la PMA, etc. Et ici, donc, on permettrait à ces couples-là de se lancer dans un projet parental, tout en veillant à ce que les risques liés à la reproduction tardive n'augmentent pas. Donc on est dans une situation assez délicate où l'eugénisme a disparu juridiquement, mais néanmoins est plus que nécessaire puisqu'on encourage les grossesses tardives. En tout cas, il y a une politique très forte à ce niveau-là qui encourage la PMA. Donc, par exemple, l'importance du cadre est déterminante néanmoins. L'importance de la biologie est déterminante, mais du cadre également. Ce qu'on peut voir, et je m'arrêterai sur ces points-là, sur ces deux points-là, dans, par exemple, l'assistance médicale à la procréation, qui n'est possible qu'en présence d'un couple marié ou non, mais en tous les cas, il faut un couple. Ou alors, par exemple, l'adoption, qui n'est possible que dans certains établissements, en tous les cas, que si l'un des conjoints ne travaille pas. Donc c'est une condition qui est imposée pour l'adoption plénière. Dans certains établissements qui s'occupent justement de l'adoption, il faut que l'un des conjoints ne travaille pas, ce qui signifie bien évidemment que ce conjoint en question s'occupe pratiquement à plein temps de l'enfance. Voilà. Donc j'ai essayé de combiner reproduction et care, qui était quand même une tentative assez ambitieuse, je l'avoue. Merci beaucoup.
I wanted to, when I started work on various religious forms of social aid, I thought it would be very easy. I thought I could go to a whole group of religious organizations. However, I limited it, for obvious reasons, to a limited area. As an anthropologist, I wanted a closer, more detailed picture rather than a broad, nationwide one. And therefore, I selected the Kansai area, specifically Osaka and Kyoto. And even there, of course, it was far too vast, and I was only able to have a rather superficial view. However, when I tried to go to these organizations and ask them for statistics and whatever, I got very unsatisfactory answers, and yet it would have been in their own interest to give me a whole series of detailed descriptions. So that was a problem. In the end, I finally realized, as has been shown by a few other studies, that in fact it is impossible to distinguish between religious organizations and let's call it various forms of either market and community organizations. Therefore, they would fit into various elements of what Professor Ochiai has called the care diamond. If we look, for example, we could start from some element of a purely legal organization, and they would often have the form of what they call NPO, that would be non-profit organizations, founded then by the law of 1998 and changed thereafter. That doesn't mean that all NPO are religious, nor does it mean that all religious organizations are NPOs. However, most of them are. At the current, in 2011, there were 41,600 NPOs, so you can see the problem of trying to get a detailed picture of these activities. So one attempt would be, first of all, a typology of these religious organizations as such, and I divided them into entirely organized by, let's say, major religious schools, such as, let's say, Utani Chinese, Shin Buddhism, etc., or sometimes by specific new religions like Risoko Seikai. Another one would be faith, interfaith organizations, and here these often might work at various levels and always in diminishing number of size, there would be organizations that would be founded and directed by an individual, let's call it a professional religious person, an ordained priest, a Buddhist, a Catholic, a pastor, whatever, or belonging to a new religion. And mainly, a lot of these are Buddhist. A person will get together independently of the school of Buddhism, let's say, to which they belong, and gather together a group of variously motivated people, often in contrast with the hierarchy. There are also, this sometimes can happen also for religious groups. I was thinking one remarkable one is called Furusato no Ie, which would be the house, let's say, native village house, again, an attempt, as one can see, to recreate community. And these, therefore, are, again, generally at a local level. Others would appear not to be particularly religious. For example, Inochi no Denwa, which is simply a lifeline, and was started in 1975 by somebody who was himself a Christian, but he was a believing Christian. He was not a member of a Christian hierarchy. The government completely ignored this service, which was tremendously successful and continues to be successful now that the suicide rate has risen, and finally has received recognition and success. And then there are mixed memberships, which are perhaps the most common, and an example of that would be for example, I take Kyoto because I was there, the YWCA, which provides a whole series of programs, although, of course, not all members are Christian. Finally, still another category could be religious organizations of foreign origin, which are active in Japan. And here we can look, for example, at a whole series, considering the Osaka, for example, of Korean Protestant churches. So what do these, why do they exist? The first point is simple. In some ways, it's connected to a crisis of mainly of the Buddhist church, which is perceived as by a lot of Japanese as being both irrelevant and as appropriating funds from parishioners and other sources without giving anything back, of having a privileged tax status or whatever. So both in the search of, let's say, social recognition, in search of also relevance, considering social change, and for that matter, simply as a going concern, a number of these churches have engaged in various forms of aid, which often are quite new. And then in the case of new religions, of course, there has been the Aum affair, and here, therefore, a major loss of credibility, not to mention others like, for example, Kiriyama and Agon Shu, who was accused of sexual abuse, and all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are many cases of this sort. So what do these organizations do? If we look at, there's a whole series of activities. If we start according to various stages of life, some, for example, have kindergartens, like the Lutheran Church. I just mentioned one example. Youth counseling, that's another problem. The idea of counseling in Japan is a vast sphere, extremely opaque and mysterious. There is no way to know exactly who counsels, what is the principle on which they are selected, the training programs, what do they say, how accountable they are, and this would be overlap with the volunteer sphere, which is also rather obscure, and it could be connected to community, but again, when somebody goes for counseling, they don't know whether the person who addresses them actually belongs to a new religion and might propose various elements that were devoted to the values and social norms of that new religion and not necessarily which might be activities approved by the government. So I repeat, kindergarten, others are, for example, helping single mothers, immigrant families, and again, here we have a problem. We have a family, but a family that due to immigration is often reduced to simply a mother and child and therefore fragile. Then there are also connected to problems of fragility of the family, shelters for domestic violence, and we reach then another phase, which would be the whole area connected to what they call, which would be grief, what they call grief care. And here, what again, we're back to various forms of perhaps both more psychological than practical aid. In some cases, of course, the grief care can be, for example, groups of people, what they call survivors of a family in which a suicide has taken place, or people who are mourning, or hospices for the dying. Here I mentioned the name of Vihara, but there are others. There are also programs that are organized in common with medical schools, because doctors claim that they do not want to face by themselves the whole problem of different values connected to death. Finally, the possibility of obtaining memorial services, funerals, for people who do not have the money to undertake these, to pay for these services, which are, after all, quite expensive. The whole idea of dying without a tomb, or which was one of the elements that led me towards this whole sector in the first place, of dying on the street, what they call yukidaori, or of the unidentified deaths, or still another area that proves, in fact, that unfortunately the family can't do everything and the community is also weak. For example, the whole problem of what they call kudokushi, the solitary deaths. And so in all of these, in theory, either to prevent or to console, to pacify after death, there are religious organizations that sometimes step in to attempt to provide consolation. There are even alternatives which are perhaps bizarre, but not but coherent in terms of popular religion, what they call pokuridera. And those, they mean drop dead quick temples. And one of them is called, for example, Yome Irazu Kannon, which means you go to a temple devoted to a bodhisattva of mercy, very well known in Japan, and you go to pray so that you drop dead and do not go through a period of dependency in which you have to rely on, at least this is the cliché, the care of your daughter-in-law. So this was an attempt to go beyond this particular state. If we look, there are other problems of this area. In many ways, you can really see that religious aid comes in precisely when the family is fragilized, or when people decide for various reasons to leave the family. For example, somebody who has debts will decide, for example, to leave the family so that the family will not have to pay for the debt, and they will end up in areas of catchment areas for great poverty. And that was one of the things that I found again in Kamagasaki, that particular urban slum, large urban slum catchment area in Osaka. And I'm surprised, in fact, that so much has been done about Tokyo and not enough, really, of this area. they were sometimes these religious organizations form networks in which they combine, and some of these, this I could have given, in fact for this I could have given a series of PowerPoint, some of the names like Janik, J-A-N-I-C, or Engaged Buddhism Net, etc. There are addresses, and these are simply higher level attempts to organize these diversified organizations. However, I was still completely unable to obtain figures. All I can obtain were figures, in fact, that proved that the statistics did not work. For example, in 2004, I think it was, there have been protests about statistics gathering connected precisely to, for example, among other things, the family. And so there was the famous case of the vanished centenarians. And this was something in which it was not religious, but it appeared that through, for a whole series of reasons, which were not only connected to welfare fraud, according to statistics based on the family register, there were at least 200,000, more than 200,000 centenarians who, in fact, were not living with their families. And there are other cases of statistical problems that emerge when an attempt to look at the more problematic cases of poverty is attempted. You tell me when to stop.
It's 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that perhaps is less might be mentioned here, again, within the alternatives, some of the elements of religious organization seem to me, but this could be seen as a personal judgment, seem to me to fit in very clearly with enlarging according to a market. Others seem to me to be based on attempts to recreate community, although one does not exclude the other. However, there is a contradiction here within what governments expect, and that is, on the one hand, there has been a large amount of what they would call a buzzword, and that would be considering self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and on the other hand, the idea of creating both strengthening the family in an age of great augmentation of divorce statistics, and as well of, for example, abandonment and increase in poverty. So I don't quite see religious agencies work in perhaps in occasionally to try to fill in certain gaps. Sometimes some also work according to principles that might seem sometimes might be described as a spontaneous compassion well, again, I would be personal. I found them quite admirable, although the whole principle of volunteering might be called into question as creating problems in an era in which there are not enough jobs. However, there are other institutions, and some of these are connected to new religions, like Kofuku no Kagaku, for example, who explained a lot of these, for example, say that any problem is, in fact, a punishment. Punishment for sins, either in this life or, of course, in a previous life, and here we might fall into certain aspects of karma. And there, another point I asked them, it was clearer, for example, in the case of explanations for, let's say, the major catastrophe in Fukushima. In this case, there were a number of religious organizations who claimed, again, that this was a divine punishment. It wasn't only Ishihara Shintaro who said that it was a divine punishment. There are a number of religious organizations who specifically said that this was sent by various divine entities as a punishment for bad behavior, collective sins, etc., etc. And this, unfortunately, is found also at other levels. People in the Salvation Army, people in some of the more fundamentalist, for example, Christian, Protestant, Korean churches are also very heavily invested in blaming poverty on sin and this again might create problems in relation to broader forms of community. I looked at other people's, biographies, but I won't go into that.
Okay. Sorry, no, it's okay. Okay.
No, so, I thought because, again, there are deeper levels of material, but I think considering the time limits, it is better to stick to principles.
Okay, so thank you very much.